Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, today we will continue with our study of the Salaika Sutta. This is Majjhima Nikaya, Discourse Number 8, translated the Discourse on Effacement. And as I explained last time, the word Salaika, which is translated here effacement, a rather unusual English word as well, means the erasing, the erosion, the gradual erosion, gradual elimination of defilements. And the sutta begins when the monk, the Venerable Mahachunda, comes to the Buddha and asks him how the abandoning of certain views come about in the world. And the Buddha, these are views that are connected with doctrines of a self or with doctrines about the world. And the Buddha explains that the abandoning of these views come about when one contemplates the object in relation to which those views arise, which underlies them, and which they are exercised upon, when one contemplates them with proper wisdom as, this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. From there, the Buddha moves into a discussion of the 8 meditative attainments, the 4 jhanas, which he says, here he now introduces the word effacement. And he says it is not these attainments that are called effacement in the Noble One's discipline. These are called pleasant abidings, happy abidings, happy dwellings, here and now in the Noble One's discipline. And then he moves to the 4 arupas, the 4 formless attainments, and says that these are not called effacement in the Noble One's discipline. These are called peaceful abidings in the Noble One's discipline. The 4 jhanas are called pleasant or happy abidings because the jhanas, at least the 3 lower jhanas, are associated with sukha, with happiness, with pleasant feeling. And even the 4th jhana, though it's connected with neutral feeling, still partakes of that happy or pleasant nature. But the 4 formless attainments are completely beyond the domain of physical form, and they're connected with very rarefied, very purified, equanimous feeling, feeling of equanimity. And so they are called peaceful abidings in the Noble One's discipline. And now, as I explained last time, the 4 jhanas and the 4 formless attainments are usually praised by the Buddha, and he usually encourages his disciples to attain them. But here he seems to be devaluing them. And this raises the interesting question why he devalues them. I could offer 2 possible answers to this. One, which accords with the explanation given in the commentary, is that the Buddha is talking about a monk who achieves these meditative states but does not use them as a basis for cultivating wisdom, for developing insight. Instead, he attains them, and after attaining them, he becomes attached to them. and he just dwells in them, enjoys them, and thinks he is eliminating defilements, or thinks he has eliminated defilements, thinks that this is true effacement, the true elimination of defilements. And so he becomes stuck. His progress is blocked. He stagnates. And he doesn't go on to cultivate insight. And so the Buddha is in no way devaluing the jhanas, the formless attainments themselves, but he's just, in a way, highlighting their limitation, that in themselves, the jhanas, the formless attainments, do not bring about the elimination, the eradication of defilements. Then I might offer another hypothesis to explain this apparent devaluing of the jhanas. And this answer or this explanation is purely speculative. I have no basis at all in any suttas to support this, but I just offer it as pure conjecture. It sometimes happens that there are people who can enter into these states of deep samadhi, deep concentration naturally, either through prior practice in previous lives or else through just some natural aptitude for samadhi. And so they might not have a highly developed ethical sense, a highly developed degree of moral purity, but just through very strong faculty of attention, it's very powerful ability to focus the mind, they can go into states of deep samadhi. And they might think that this is right concentration. And so the Buddha, if we take the sutta as a whole, the Buddha is going to backtrack away from these states of deep concentration and emphasize the need to achieve moral purity, purity of speech, purity of action, purity of intention, and introduce the need for the intention to eliminate unwholesome states of mind as the prerequisite for gaining right concentration, the concentration that is a true and integral part of the Noble Eightfold Path, the path that will lead to the extinction of suffering. Okay, so from this resume of what we covered last time and some hypothetical explanations for this passage, for these rather unusual presentation here, we now move into paragraph 12, the paragraph that's concerned with the practice of effacement itself. And before we go into the actual text, I should point out that we're going to see 44 ways of practicing effacement dealt with in five principal modes. These five principal modes form the themes of discussion in paragraphs, sections 12 through 16 in the sutta. The five principal modes will be simply how effacement should be practiced, then the section or division on what is called the inclination of mind towards wholesome states. Then the section on the avoidance of unwholesome states. That's section 3. Then 4 is the division on the way leading downwards and the way leading upwards. And section 5 is the division on the the way of extinguishing, the way of extinguishing defilements. So each section, each of these major sections, these major divisions, will run through all 44 ways of practicing effacement, or all 44 items that are dealt with in the section on practicing effacement. So it's like a wheel which runs through these 44 modes five different times, each time dealing with them from a different angle. So let's now go take the section, the first section on effacement, and explore what are these 44 ways themselves. The first is, others will be cruel. We shall not be cruel here. Effacement should be practiced thus. And we will see as we go through these 44 items that most of them fall into certain fixed groups, familiar groups from the suttas. But this first one, others will be cruel, we shall not be cruel here, this one does not belong to a fixed group. But according to the commentary or sub-commentary, it's placed at the very beginning to emphasize that harmlessness, non-injury to others, is the very foundation or basis of the brahmacharya, of the religious life, the holy life. This goes back to the very ancient principle in Indian spirituality that if one is to lead a truly religious life, the least one could do is to avoid inflicting harm on others. And this idea of harmlessness was very fundamental to the Jain teaching. The Jains were contemporaries of the Buddha, and the Buddha himself made it one of the pillars of his own teaching. And in Buddhism, this principle of harmlessness becomes developed further into the idea of compassion, of feeling empathy with the sufferings of others. But at the starting point, or at the beginning, one has to start with avoiding inflicting harm on others. Just as with the five precepts, the first precept is the precept not to kill, not to destroy life. And it's interesting to observe the form in which each of these reflections takes. Each one takes the form, others will be so-and-so, we shall not be so-and-so. Others will do so-and-so, we shall not do so-and-so. What are the implications of this? Venerable Jnanaponika, in a note in his translation of the sutta, points out that here we have, I'll just paraphrase his idea. He points out that when one sets out to lead a spiritual life, one has to be fixed in one's determination to follow this path, without casting sideways glances at the behavior of others. We don't use the conduct of others as a standard for our own behavior, but rather we regulate our behavior by the guidelines, the principles, the standards that we think are correct. Particularly, we look to the Dhamma, to the Buddha's teaching, as the basis for our standards, for our guidelines. And once we determine to follow these standards, then we remain fixed in our determination. without seeing whether others are also behaving in the same way, pursuing the same ideals. Because generally, even in a Buddhist, so-called Buddhist society, many people will be acting contrary to the precepts. Many people will not be training themselves properly. But this should not discourage us. This should not deter us from our decision, our determination to follow this proper path. And so, and so each of these themes for effacement, for the elimination of defilements, takes the form of a determination to follow a particular course without concern for the behavior of others. And so we begin with this determination not to be cruel, not to inflict harm on others in any way. Then we come to the next one, number two. But if we look down the list, we will see that number two is actually the beginning of a familiar set, which runs from number two down to number 11. And this set is what we call the 10 courses. On the one side, the negative side, the 10 courses of unwholesome action. And on the positive side, the 10 courses of wholesome action. So we have, as the 10 courses of wholesome action, 3 of the body: abstain from killing living beings, abstain from taking what is not given, abstain. But now this sutta is given to monks. Amongst the 10 courses of wholesome action for general population, abstain from sexual misconduct, which means to abstain from adultery, seduction, and so on. But now the Buddha is speaking to his monastic disciples, so he says others will be non-celibate, sexually indulgent, but we shall be celibate here. Effacement should be practiced thus. So these 3 pertain to the body. The next 4 pertain to speech: to abstain from false speech, to abstain from malicious speech, to abstain from harsh speech. Then to abstain from idle chatter or gossip. Then we have 3 that are purely mental, purely take place within the mind: to abstain from covetousness, that is, to avoid excessive greed, the greed that wants to gain possession of the belongings of others; ill will, the impulse to harm, to hurt others; to abstain from wrong view, but to hold right view; to have, especially in this case, the right view of the moral efficacy of action, the right view of karma and its fruits. Okay, so this is set number 2, which goes from factors 2 to 11. Now, if we look at number 12, we have others will be of wrong intention, we shall be of right intention here. That begins the next set. And then you look down, number 13, we see avoiding wrong speech, having right speech. And we go all the ways down to others will be of wrong concentration, we shall be of right concentration here. Effacement shall be practiced thus. These factors all seem familiar. We have 7 factors here. These are 7 factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. And so we might have the question, what factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is missing from this set? The factor that's missing is right view. But if we raise the question, why is right view missing from that set? What is the answer? If you look a little closely at this list of factors, the answer should be obvious, that there's an overlapping of two sets of terms. The 10 courses of wholesome action end with right view, and right view number 11 actually begins the 8 factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. And so here we have the Noble Eightfold Path from factors 12 We have the Noble Eightfold Path from factors 11 up until number up through number 18. Okay, following number 18, we have two more factors. 19 is others will be of wrong knowledge. We shall be of right knowledge here. Others will be of wrong deliverance, wrong liberation. We shall be of right liberation here. Effacement should be practiced thus. These two factors are sometimes joined to the 8 factors of the Noble Eightfold Path to form what are called the 10 factors of the accomplished one, of the arahant, of one who has no more training to accomplish. Right knowledge will be the perfect, clear knowledge of the Four Noble Truths, and right liberation is the liberation of the mind of all defilements. And these are possessed only by the arahant. So these two factors express the aspiration, the intention to achieve the perfection of arhatship. Okay, now we come factors 21. Factors beginning with 21. We have others will be overcome by sloth and torpor. We shall be free from sloth and torpor here. Then others will be restless. We shall not be restless here. Others will be doubters. We shall go beyond doubt here. These three, if you look at them closely and you know the different sets within the Dhamma, you might recognize them as three of the five hindrances. The five hindrances are the main obstacles in developing the meditative mind, the mind that will culminate in right samadhi, right concentration, and also the mind that will be capable of clear insight. And so, to achieve right samadhi and right insight, we have to break through these five hindrances. And we see three of the hindrances mentioned here. Why not all five of them? If you review the different factors that we've already considered, the answer will present itself. If you look at Items number 9, you see covetousness, which means strong greed, and that is approximately a synonym for, in some context, for sensual desire. And then we have, following covetousness, we have ill will, vyapada, that is the second hindrance itself. So the first two hindrances, sensual desire and ill will are already covered by the factors number 9 and 10. So in this presentation of the list, there's no need to repeat them, since one has already made the intention to overcome those hindrances. Okay, now we continue with from item number 24, others will be angry. We shall not be angry here. Effacement should be practiced thus. Others will be resentful here. We shall not be resentful here. Others will be contemptuous. We will not be contemptuous here. Others will be insolent. We shall not be insolent here. Others will be envious. We shall not be envious here. Others will be avaricious. We shall not be avaricious here, or we say selfish or miserly. Others will be fraudulent. We shall not be fraudulent. Others will be deceitful. We shall not be deceitful. Others will be obstinate. We shall not be obstinate here. Others will be arrogant. We shall not be arrogant here. Okay, these factors plus number 36, others will be negligent. We shall be diligent here. These factors are 13. These 13 items are included within the 16 upakilesas, the 16 imperfections or corruptions of the mind, which we've already studied in the simile of the cloth, the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 7. These items, plus we take number 9 and 10 from the Courses of Unwholesome Action. So altogether, we cover 13 of the 16 imperfections that defile the mind. There are 3 that are missing, namely rivalry, that's sarumba, I think, conceit, and vanity. And the question might be raised, why should the text include 13 of those imperfections or defilements of the mind rather than all 16? Why were these 3 omitted? Seems rather strange. And those 3 could just as equally have been included with equal justification. The only answer that I could think of is that perhaps the compilers of this discourse wanted to have a very neat round number, like 44, and so they had to delete certain items. Or perhaps the sutta originally consisted of a smaller number of items, and over generations, as the sutta was transmitted from one generation to the next, more and more items came to be added. Or perhaps originally those 3 were included and somehow they dropped out in the course of oral transmission. We just can't be sure, but one thing that we can be sure of is that in personal training, one should also make the effort to overcome this tendency to rivalry, conceit, and vanity. Those are also corruptions of the mind. Okay, that... Next, we take number 34, which is, others will be difficult to admonish. We shall be easy to admonish here, and others will have bad friends, but we shall have good friends here. Effacement should be practiced thus. These 2 items are not part of any fixed list with a single name over it, but they are frequently mentioned in the suttas as qualities essential to the training, especially the training of a monk. It's often said that when the monks become difficult to admonish and don't accept instruction respectfully, this is a sign, an indication that the Buddha's teaching is about to decline and to deteriorate. There are suttas when the Buddha asks the Venerable Mahakasapa to instruct the monks, and Venerable Mahakasapa refuses and says, "I'm sorry, Venerable Sir, but now the monks have become very difficult to instruct. They don't accept instruction easily. They're difficult to admonish." And then again and again, the Buddha has pointed out the importance of avoiding bad friends, those friends who might be pleasant, cheerful, agreeable, but lead one astray, lead one down the wrong path. Those types of friends who have a corrupting influence upon one's character, upon one's standards. And the importance of cultivating good friendship, friendship with good people who will inspire you, instruct you, serve as true models, and really try to benefit you and to help you cultivate the Buddha's path. Okay, so I should say, instead of being difficult to admonish, one should try to be easy to admonish. That is, one should be ready to instruct, to accept instructions respectfully, be easy, be ready to follow the instructions, and then one should have good friends. And then avoiding negligence, being diligent. I already explained this in connection with the Upakilesa Sutta, so I won't give an explanation here. Then we come, number 37 to 43. This forms a set of seven factors, which are elsewhere called the seven good qualities. And their opposite, their negative opposite, are the seven bad qualities. Okay, we go through these. Others will be without faith, but we shall have faith here. This stresses the importance of having faith in the sense of confidence or trust in the Buddha, his teaching, the noble Sangha, the community of noble ones. And others will be shameless, without any sense of moral shame. We shall be shameful here, not in the sense of being ashamed or having this rather negative self-reproach, but what's called shame here is actually the sense of self-respect. It is the voice, the inner voice of conscience, which protects one from wrongdoing. It is the voice, I call it the sense of inner dignity, this voice, the inner sense that protects one from engaging in unwholesome actions, unworthy actions, because to do so mars, spoils, corrodes the inherent dignity of one's person, the potential purity and nobility of one's own mind. And its counterpart is called, in Pali, otapa. This is called, we might translate this as the sense of moral dread. Here it's translated fear of wrongdoing. So whereas others might have no fear of wrongdoing, we shall be afraid of wrongdoing here. This fear of wrongdoing or moral dread is what protects one from doing unwholesome actions because one is afraid of the consequences of those actions. One recognizes that if one does unwholesome actions and others find out that one has done them, others will blame one. Others will criticize you. Others will avoid you. Others will reject you. Of course, there'll be others who will accept you, will congratulate you, but the type of people that you want to be respected by, the other people that you want to be admired by, those are the people who will criticize you, avoid you, reproach you. And also, and extremely important, one recognizes the karmic consequences of those actions. That when one engages in unwholesome actions, one is creating negative karma, unwholesome karma, which is bound to produce its results, leading to one's own suffering and affliction in time to come, leading one away from one's connection with the noble path and bringing one into states of misery and suffering over perhaps countless aeons in the future. Sometimes a contrast is drawn between Buddhism and Christianity, and it's said that whereas Christianity tries to persuade people to be moral by filling them with fear, Buddhism doesn't. Buddhism teaches people to be moral purely because of the inherent benefits of morality. But this isn't quite true, I have to say. The Buddha spoke often and sometimes in quite extensive detail about the negative consequences of unwholesome actions. He spoke about the unhappy planes of rebirth, about how unwholesome actions lead to a fall away from the human realm into the animal realm, the realm of the unhappy spirits, even to the hell realm. And he spoke about countless lives that one might have to spend in the hells. And that is a strong motivation for avoiding unwholesome actions. Okay, next comes, others will be of little learning here. We shall be of great learning. This encourages not just worldly learning, but gaining extensive knowledge of the Dharma, of the Buddha's teaching. Then we come to the factors, three factors concerned directly with the development of the higher stages of the path. Others will be lazy. We shall be energetic here. This, in effect, is almost the same as right effort. In a way, this we could say is a duplication, but I think in this case, the text, the Buddha or the compilers wanted to include all seven of these good qualities, and so they didn't mind having the duplication. Others will be unmindful. We shall be established in mindfulness here. Or we shall have mindfulness set up here. Again, this duplicates right mindfulness, but it was felt important to have this extra stress on right mindfulness. Then others will be without wisdom. We shall possess wisdom here. Okay, so this, again, comes to a culmination in wisdom. Wisdom is that factor of the path that brings liberation. But now we end with a very interesting factor. Others will adhere to their own views, hold on to them tenaciously, and relinquish them with difficulty. We shall not adhere to our own views or hold on to them tenaciously, but shall relinquish them easily. Effacement shall be practiced thus. Okay, this item emphasizes the importance of not clinging to one's own views, to one's own opinions. We might think that when we have opinions, we could hold on to them tightly and argue in their defense, and that is not a defilement. But in the presentation here, that is also an obstacle. It's an indication of a rigid, narrow, dogmatic mind, a mind which is beset by clinging, by grasping. And so, to get free from all types of clinging, all types of grasping, one has to give up this narrow fixation of adhering tenaciously to one's own views and refusing to relinquish them when necessary. Now, this doesn't mean that one gives up right view and that one doesn't hold any view at all. According to the Buddha's teaching, right view is extremely important, and right view is what clears the path of a lot of confusion, misunderstanding, and deluded thinking. But when one holds right view, one does so without clinging to it as one more dogmatic position. One holds right view, but one doesn't cling to it as my view. One uses right view as a means to gain right understanding of reality. And when one confronts others who hold wrong views, one doesn't engage with them in battling over different opinions. If you get into arguments with others, right, my view is right, your view is wrong, then even if your view is right, but if you're engaged in arguments and disputes, then in a sense you are no better than they are. But rather you hold right view with a flexible mind, with an open mind, without clinging to that view, without grasping it as your own. In this way, that right view becomes a means to liberation rather than an obstacle. Okay, so with this we cover all 44 themes as means to effacement. We take each of these themes, we reflect on them, we can even go through as a spiritual practice, go through these 44 themes every day, doing it as useful, or select a few of them that are useful and practice them every day. And little by little, they will help to wear away the particular negative or unwholesome factors to which they are opposed. Okay, this will conclude our presentation for this evening. In the next discourse, I will take the continuation of the sutta. I thank you all for your attention, and let us now share the merits with the devas and with the other beings. Akasata cha bhumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabhumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabhumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mang Parang Etavata Cha Amhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabbe Deva Anumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya Etavata Cha Amhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabbe Bhutanumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya Etavata Cha Amhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabbe Sata Anumodantu.